Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, coming up in the next hour of the programme, can artificial intelligence really take over? We hear why some experts are concerned. Our gardeners will be here with a list of all those spring jobs that you know you really should be getting down to now. We'll have a taste or two of Callan's Kicks, and at 11:30, the gathering will kick the week when we look back at the big stories of the last few days. Just to bring you some news from the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation, they've analysed figures for March and they found that it has been the worst month for overcrowding on record since the INMO began counting trolleys in 2006. So 12,943 admitted patients, including 447 children, have been treated on trolleys or chairs in this past month. And the General Secretary of the INMO, Phil Nihay, said in some hospitals, the level of overcrowding has been out of control. And she says it cannot be allowed to continue into the spring and summer months. Now, Colm Tobin, Laureate for Irish Fiction, was presented with the Bodley Medal in Oxford last night for his sustained contribution to literature. He also has some good news for fans of his novel Brooklyn. Colm, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. Thank you so much for joining us after that big night last night. We're going to talk to you as well about your view of the Good Friday Agreement. So we've a lot of ground to cover this morning. But first, congratulations on that award last night in Oxford. How did that go?
It was just great. There was a big audience and they gave me a medal. I was laughing later, you know, in Ireland they'd say, you deserve a medal for that. You know,
well, you got it.
Well, I finally got my medal, so I have it now, so I can show it to anyone who wants to see it.
And the news this week from your publisher, all delighted to hear about the follow-up to Brooklyn on the way, but we have to wait, don't we, until May of next year?
Yeah, that's the way it goes. It just takes longer between the delivery of a manuscript and the publication of a book now. But it is finished, and so I can maybe do a bit of revision. But yeah, it'll be in May of next year.
And are you allowed or permitted to tell us anything about Long Island?
Yeah, it's 25 years after the ending of of Brooklyn. It has the same characters. She's married, and she's married to Tony, you know, and she's got two kids, and she's living in Long Island with the extended family in sort of four houses they built for the grandparents and for the two brothers. And it's a sort of an idyllic life for her, except I got an idea as I was walking along the street one day for something really disruptive. I didn't expect this, but something happens, and that then is the beginning of the novel, and that causes her to come back to Ireland. So, so suddenly she's back in Scorthy after all the years.
I was intrigued to read in your blog as Laureate your comments about plot, and you said a plot came to you during the pandemic. You wrote it and then you felt, I will never be able to do this again.
Yeah, you feel about plot when you're actually able to connect. You're able to have an action and then you're able to show the unexpected consequences of that action. And that seems plausible, and bring the reader further into another consequence, and that's plot. And the problem is that when you think about it, you think, I'll never get anything as neat and tidy and plausible as that again. A lot of writers don't do plot anymore. You know, the novel is all atmosphere, it's all about style and language, and so this is a novel with plot. And yeah, the feeling always is, I got that by accident. That came into my head by chance. I was lucky that day. I'll never be as lucky as this again. So it's not a sort of scientific process that you can go into and start writing and feel, you know, that it will come right on its own. Often it does, but you don't know how that happened or why. Or why was that day rather than another?
And those comments were about this book, were they?
Yeah.
Right. The film, of course, hugely successful. And since the news was announced the other day, we've all seen those little gorgeous pictures taking us back of Saoirse Ronan and Donald Gleeson. But if it's 25 years on now, it'll be tricky for them to go back and play those characters.
Yeah, I think if you write a novel thinking about a film, you lose the novel and you lose the film. You know, in other words, I had to concentrate on these characters, on getting the plot right, on, you know, moving it along, on making it work. And if I start thinking about film during that, I really am just losing the run of myself. You know, in other words, I think if you get that right once, as I think we did with Brooklyn, the chances again of doing that twice are slim, except for Godfather 2. But there again, this is not a mafia story, you know. So I think it's just, you know, it's a while away, and you know, it's not made for Saoirse in the sense that the woman in question is in her mid 40s.
A funny thing happens to our brains, and I'm just interested to get the novelist's perspective on this, because when I read a book and then I see the film, I can't think about that book without seeing the character in the movie. So Saoirse, for example, in this case, when you're writing your sequel to Brooklyn, are you seeing her, or can you erase that from your mind?
I wasn't seeing Saoirse as much as I was seeing Donald Gleeson sometimes. That there was a particular performance of his where he was playing this very shy, sort of solid fellow who owns a bar in Enniscorthy. And you know, I wrote to him at the time just saying that this is a very original performance, because the guy is so quiet, he's so good, he's so decent. And a lot of times actors don't get to play those Irishmen, and Irishmen are always shouting, or they're cutting off their fingers, or they're, you know, they're doing something crazy. But he was so solid. And I was interested in that performance, and I think that performance had an effect on the new novel, on Long Island.
That's interesting. And that description puts Paul Mescal and Normal People into my mind as well, the quieter,
yeah,
sort of Irish man and
yeah,
a portrayal of,
yeah,
that. Now, let's go all the way back to a book you wrote in your 30s, Bad Blood, The Long Walk Along the Border. And that was written before the Good Friday Agreement, of course, of 25 years ago. And it's pertinent that we talk about this now, coming up to the anniversary. Will you remind us, Colm, what you found back then?
Well, I found, for example, that the Kingsmill massacre that had occurred in 1976, in 1986, 10 years later, really haunted that particular landscape around Bessborough and Kingsmills. And that there were two survivors from the 12 men who were coming home that evening on the minibus. The minibus was stopped, and they didn't know what group it was. It could have even been the British Army, but they were told to get out, and the one Catholic was told to identify himself. He thought he was going to be shot, but he was told to run, and they trained the guns on the 11 Protestants, and one survived. And he was Alan Black, and one Catholic survived, obviously the man who was told to run. So I went into that village, knocking on doors, and I found that poor Catholic man was, I mean, he was like someone haunted. He could barely speak. He just said, "No, I've never spoken to anyone about that." And I, you know, got one question, which was, did you think they were going to shoot you? And he said, "What would you have thought?"
Mm-hmm.
And then he slowly closed the door, you know. But Alan Black, who was the survivor on the Protestant side, he was just incredibly kind to me. And, you know, you're a Catholic from the South knocking on the door of a Protestant who has been shot so badly. You're always under suspicion, and you always feel, you know, people are going to turn you away just for that reason. He was incredibly nice to me. He could not have been more helpful. And that was a constant, where I was constantly knocking on doors, just asking people to tell me what had happened. And some people just wanted to close the door and just nothing, you know. And others, for example, Pastor Bain in Darkley, which was the church that was shot up by the INLA during service, he could not have been more friendly. But his first question was, "Are you in the IRA?" I said, "No, Pastor, I'm not in the IRA." You know? But he had never been south. And there were so many people who had never been over the border and viewed the south of Ireland with immense suspicion. And it looked intractable, because the Protestant side were so wounded, and especially in the Fermanagh area, where there have been so many killings of people who were just ordinary farmers. But of course, some ordinary farmers had joined the UDR, and that left them as targets. And of course, they were targeted. I was just wandering in and out of this, listening to story after story every day. And it was just, I suppose, the overwhelming idea was just absolute sadness. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, still a sort of fear. And as my book was coming out, the bomb happened at Enniskillen on Remembrance Day, and it just struck me, you know, wow, like putting a bomb. And the problem we have still is that we don't know who did that bomb, and we don't know who did the Kingsmill massacre. People have never been identified who perpetrated those crimes, and so, you know, we're still locked into a sort of spiral in which there's no end. People could be passing someone on the street. They could still be alive who did Kingsmill.
Northern Ireland, I think, for many of us who grew up in the Republic, was seen almost as an alien place because we didn't visit very often. And I know I was spent some time in Leitrim with cousins, and we would go on this little day trip to Enniskillen. And one summer, the centre of the town was there, and the next summer, it wasn't. And that was so alien. It was so foreign, you know, as a child who grew up in peaceful County Laois. But for you, in writing that book and going through that experience that you just described, you came to understand the Unionist point of view. And that was the point, was it not, to explain that view to people in the Republic?
Yeah, but there were times when the Catholic side had suffered equally. And so there were times when I interviewed people, you know, who had been, for example, had family killed by the British Army. But there were other moments that were stranger. For example, the 12th of July in Fermanagh is not like the 12th of July in Derry or in Belfast. It's a big day out in a field, and it's much more like a picnic. I was very surprised by it. There was no sectarian violence. There was no, you know, marching through other people's streets. This happens elsewhere in Northern Ireland on the 12th. Fermanagh is different. And also Fermanagh, you know, there was no retaliation against Catholics, as there would have been, say, in Belfast, in Fermanagh. So I had to always watch myself, because as you moved along the border, things changed, the landscape changed. Sometimes there were really poor land, other times really beautiful big fields and big farms. Poor land tended to be owned by Catholics, the big fields by Protestants. So you were constantly watching out, because things were different as you moved along. So to talk about Northern Ireland as a single entity, or the border as a single entity, was hard, especially when you arrived finally in South Armagh, which really was, as a border area, very different to the border area between, say, Fermanagh and Monaghan.
And you wrote about the bitter opposition from the Unionist community to the Anglo-Irish Treaty at the time. So then, when we look at the Good Friday Agreement, can you explain the success of that and why it eventually became acceptable to both sides to a certain extent in a way that the Anglo-Irish Agreement didn't?
Yeah, I mean, Alan Black, who's a survivor of the Kingsmill massacre, when I asked him about the Anglo-Irish Agreement and his opposition to it, he said it's a question of arbitrary authority. And, you know, our oppositions, for example, to the Pope's rule in Rome, is it's an arbitrary authority. We have no, it's not accountable to anyone. Similarly, the Irish government wants a say in Northern Ireland, but we have no power in Northern Ireland over electing or not electing the Irish government. So suddenly an outside power that we have no, is not accountable to us, is coming in to partly rule our country. And I had not thought about this that way before. But of course, with the Good Friday Agreement, there was a referendum, so the same sort of democratic deficit didn't exist. But I think there was something ingenious in the Anglo-Irish Agreement itself. And there were two words, and they seem to me the two most beautiful words in Ireland that you could use now, which is the words "and both." In other words, that your identity in Northern Ireland could be Irish, it could be British, or both, and both. And the idea that, you know, somebody could be like they could love the NHS, and they could love the GAA. They could listen to RTE, but they could, you know, depend on the BBC for news. And there's so many areas in which people in Northern Ireland, that the identity is now ambivalent. There could be a Presbyterian in Fermanagh who has an Irish passport now, but wouldn't dream of going south. That it's not a single opposition to anything, as much as a lot of ambivalences about identity in the North. And I think the Anglo-Irish Agreement represented those sort of ambivalences and allow them to have a sort of, I suppose, a political dimension. The problem now we have, I think, is that it's a binary business. In other words, that you have to be nationalist or you have to be unionist in a future Stormont. And it makes the position of the Alliance Party, as it grows, particularly difficult, because they can never actually hold power under the agreement. They have to be one or the other.
Yes, and they campaign on that fact. They say, yeah, you know, that they can't not have a place in that binary system.
And I mean, I think, you know, if you're a Catholic and you go to Queen's University, there's so many people in Northern Ireland who, you know, are involved one way or the other with the Northern Irish state, who may be Catholic and may dissent from the state in some way and not in another. So that people might see the Alliance Party as a way out of that sort of trap of being one or the other. Certainly, if I was living in Northern Ireland, I would really object to the idea that I had to be Catholic or it had to be nationalist or unionist, and that it was one or the other. I think I would find that a very difficult position. It's like being asked, are you Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, and you have to be one or the other. And I think anyone in the Republic would say, hold on a moment.
And have we reached that ambition, the and both ambition, or the ambition of and both? Where are we now?
I think it's complex and it's ambivalent and it's changing. But I mean, my view is that talking of a United Ireland when there's no electoral evidence that anybody has changed their position on United Ireland. You know, it isn't as though we're watching some pro-United Ireland unionist group emerge. We're not. And so it, talking about it as though somehow the majority population, the unionists in Northern Ireland, don't matter or can be easily convinced at some point in the near future seems to me to be dangerous, because what we need more than anything else in Northern Ireland is stability, mm-hmm. is political stability, is as much political stability as possible, so that other energies can emerge, such as, for example, the women's movement or the gay movement or even the movement surrounding the protection of immigrants, that there are many other things that have to be dealt with in Northern Ireland, including, if I could mention, integrated education.
Colm, I didn't even get to talk to you about your laureate work. I know it's ongoing. Your Art of Reading book club is where you bring an Irish author to a library book club, and people can find information on the Arts Council website if they go to artscouncil.ie/laureate. But for now, we need to leave it there, and I hope we get the opportunity to speak again soon. Congratulations on your medal, as you put it yourself,
that you
got
medal
last night, the Bodley medal. Colm, thank you so much for taking the time
thank
to speak to
much.
Us. Colm Tobin, laureate for Irish fiction. We'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.